This is Food Secure Nation with Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson. Sponsored by Know Better, Do Better, KBDB. Engaging change makers, charting solutions, and driving progress for food security in America. Dr. Phil Knight.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for listening. At Food Secure Nation, we believe food insecurity is not a mystery. Among other things, it's a systems problem. And system problems don't yield to just slogans. They really yield to understanding. And that's why we frame food security as the United Nations did through the six dimensions of food security: availability, access, utilization, stability, sustainability, and agency. Together, they give us a way to see the whole system: how food is produced, how it moves, how families experience it, and how policy decisions, often made far from kitchen tables, shape real outcomes in people's lives. Today's conversation sits right at the intersection of evidence, policy, and trust. Our guest, Dr. Cheryl Kirshenbaum, brings a rare and deeply needed perspective to this work. Cheryl's academic training spans science, policy, and governance, not just how systems are supposed to work, but how they actually do. Her background in science and technology studies, combined with real-world experience in federal policy spaces, gives her a unique lens on how evidence becomes law, how incentives shape behavior, and why well-intended programs sometimes miss the mark. And that matters, because food insecurity doesn't exist in isolation. Policy choices around nutrition, healthcare, workforce participation, agriculture, and state and federal partnerships all intersect in the lives of families trying to stay afloat. When one part of the system shifts, whether it's SNAP, Medicaid, commodity programs, or work requirements, the effect ripples across households, states, and communities. In this conversation, we'll explore how policy can better align with the six dimensions of food security, not necessarily by expanding government for its own sake, and not by retreating from responsibility, but by designing policies that are coherent, accountable, and centered on real human outcomes. Because food security, done well, is not about dependency. It's about stability. It's about agency. And it's about building systems that allow people to participate fully in their families, their work, and their communities. That's the conversation we're having today on Food Secure Nation. Welcome back, everyone. Great to be with you. And Jerry Brisson sitting across from me. It's lovely to see you. And you get a rare privilege, my friend.
I do. And, you know, I have to say, I so enjoy the monologues. And I really do. But I couldn't wait for this one to be over. But it's not your fault. Yeah. It's because we have Cheryl Kirshenbaum on the show today, who is one of our favorite guests. Somebody who is so smart and so just good to talk to, thoughtful in so many ways. It's you know, I hate to say it, but I couldn't wait for the monologue to be done.
Well, you know, that's not the first and it won't be the last. But welcome, Dr. Cheryl Kirshenbaum. Cheryl, thank you for being back with us on our new rebranded show, Food Secure Nation. And that's what we all are working, hoping, and praying for.
Well, I could not be more excited to be on the show, and I feel exactly the same way about being back. I'm delighted to talk to both of you again, and I hope that the show is really successful and it helps all of us get a little closer to maybe achieving a food secure nation.
That'd be great. That's our dream for sure. So, since the last time you've been with us, you have been globe trotting quite a bit, and back in D.C., where you've spent a good portion, invested a good portion of your handful of life and shaping policy and trying to get the right votes to line up. And tell us about, just update our listeners, where you've been, what you've been up to, and kind of where you're at right now.
Sure. I was fortunate enough to be an international affairs fellow through the Council on Foreign Relations, where I got placed in Senator Gary Peters' office, who is one of our Michigan senators, of course. So I was working on agricultural policy, environment, a lot of the science stuff, Great Lakes, a whole bunch of different issues. But of course, issues related to food and food security are near and dear to my heart. So I felt very privileged to be able to spend time thinking about food security in Michigan and then across the country as well.
Well, it's great. And I got to see you there in Senator Peters' office, and we got to catch up a little bit. And now you're back in Michigan, back at Michigan State. And, of course, you know, from years past, you know, there's been a PBS experience. There's been NPR. There's, you know, your own show, Emmy Award winning. All, you know, wow, Jerry, how do we get her on?
I don't know, but we should keep doing it.
Yeah, it is good to be back at Michigan State. I mean, go green.
Yeah, go white.
And what a delight to see your name on my calendar coming through our office. I just thought this is a conversation I'm so happy to be having at such an important time, because I am always grateful for the work that you're doing to try to make sure families and communities across the state have enough to eat, not just in terms of access, but in terms of all the different ways we think about food and sustainability. So, it was a real treat to be able to say hi to you when I was in the Senate.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. It was encouraging for our whole group to be with you and your team there. And now we have so many people that are listening to the show all across the nation. Some 13 different countries are downloading. People are downloading the podcast and subscribing. So it is a topic that is near and dear to many, many people in the nation. And we're proud, of course, to be a part of the Feeding America world. And through that work of some 250 food banks, they're serving every county in America. So we can get this done. So that's where we want to talk with you about is how looking at some of the policies that really respect people. Looking at the issue of agency, how do we include people in, not as a part of a problem, but really as a people that are worthy of investment and part of a solution? So I know you've been listening to folks who have been in this work and who've been in these circumstances for years now, and we'd love to have your take. What are your thoughts?
Well, I would love to talk to you about it. I can't pretend I have all the answers, although I really wish I did. But I think there are a lot of dimensions to the challenge of food insecurity that we often don't think about when we're first approaching a policy context. So maybe we could start with some of those.
That'd be perfect.
So one of the first things that I try to keep in mind is that when we have these conversations, we're most often talking about food access. So we're talking about things like SNAP benefits, we're talking about food banks, and those are, you know, absolutely fundamental. But it's easy to kind of take away from attention to the interaction between food security and other stressors. And what I mean by that is like housing instability, transportation deserts, work schedule unpredictability. People have real lives, so it's not just about access through, you know, benefits, and then we're done. It's like we need to be thinking about people as folks out in the world living their lives with real stressors, with whether it's with parents, with kids, needing to get around, get to the doctor, do different things, go about their lives, but also ensure that our systems are set up to support access to food throughout all of those different parts of their day. And I don't think we spend a lot of time on that. I think our policies in general tend to address acute hunger, but maybe not, say, chronic uncertainty that shapes decision-making for families and for communities. So those are some of the things that I'm thinking about in terms of a system approach.
Yeah, and I like that a lot, because as we, you know, part of the work we're trying to do now is to frame the issue of food security in a way that people can understand why it's not so simple. I mean, one of the things we often say is the less you know about a problem, the easier it is to solve.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right? So the converse of that is you learn more, and as you learn more, you go, oh, yeah, that's why this is persistent. It's why it hasn't gone away yet. And it's not about effort, and it's not about people's desire to see the problem solved. It's that you got to take time to look at all of the dimensions that create food insecurity, and then you got to think about, of those things, what are things we can reasonably handle and in what kind of time frame? And if it's complicated, it's going to take some time. I mean, one of the things that we find frustrates people is they just want things to be done now. And it's like, well, I mean, you know, if you're going to tackle a multifaceted problem with something like an effective solution that works for the actual people who it's intended for, you have to talk to people. You have to learn what people's objections and concerns are. You have to learn what really works. You need to engage, right? And you're not going to sit alone in your office and solve problems like this. So as you think about this issue of engaging, right, which is one of the reasons I really like that you were in D.C. engaging on these issues. I mean, did you find as you were working on things that you could get people's ear because, you know, they really do get that this food issue needs to be solved?
I think that food access and food security, that's part of a conversation that isn't as hard to convince folks they should be paying attention to. Now, I'm not saying it's perfect. I think we saw a lot of harm to community food banks and other spaces just in the past year. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, actually, you two said this to me a long time ago, but child and hunger should never be part of the same sentence. That's a line I learned from you that I still use to this day. I think it touches all of us. I mean, for me, it's as a parent, as a member of my community, we live in a nation where we have enough food, but we don't distribute it in a way where it reaches everyone. So there are real solutions. And I think starting those conversations with points of connection like that really do tug at people's heartstrings and make them want to listen to what you have to say next, at least more so than a lot of other issues that I work on.
And so as you're navigating these systems and really thinking about how do you personally leverage your opportunity to make an impact, and Phil's telling me we're almost out of time in this segment, so you might have to think about this for a minute. We'll come back to it in the next segment. But as someone who's invested your handful of life in this for quite some time, where do you feel like your best opportunities have been, and where do you think our best opportunities are? And
we'll be right back.
You're listening to Food Secure Nation with Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson, sponsored by Know Better, Do Better.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for being with us. Dr. Phil Knight here with Jerry Brisson, our guest, Dr. Cheryl Kirschenbaum. And Jerry, what's the cliffhanger?
Well, the cliffhanger is really, Cheryl, just getting more an in-depth perspective of, as you've invested your time and energy in this issue, what are the things that you've learned the most from, and what are the things that you're kind of pursuing now as best opportunities?
Oh, my goodness. So many different ways to answer that question. One of the things I think a lot about, especially coming off of the year on the Hill, is that these mismatches exist between how people behave and what the policies do. For example, if you're talking about SNAP, there's work requirements that they're supposedly meant to promote employment, but then sometimes they can push minimal wage increases as there's like a punishment for that, where suddenly you're earning just a little too much to maintain your benefit. And so it doesn't really incentivize employment. It gets you working, but it doesn't kind of keep you there. There's things like administrative burdens. Now, I'm not someone who loves doing paperwork. I'm not particularly good at all the details. But if you want access to every program, we have often separate applications. You have different eligibility thresholds. You have different recertification schedules. And it's like this, I guess you call it like a kind of coordination tax that people applying for these benefits have to pay. So I feel like with some little kind of levers, we can streamline some of this, make it a bit easier for families and individuals who are already juggling a million different challenges, because living below a certain household income is really, really hard to begin with. And we can relieve both some of the burden of having all of those extra challenges just to get the benefits that, frankly, we as the country can pretty easily provide easier access to.
That I love that, Cheryl, because for me, sitting in the chair that I've been in for a number of years looking at this work, what I've seen is what you just said, how policy is enacted and how it misaligns with human behavior, with how people act.
Exactly.
So the policy will say, hey, we want you to work. And the vast experience I've had with people has been, we want to work, but they can't make enough. We say they got more month than they do money. And so what the policy ends up doing is de-incentivizing work. And the result is a financial cliff. And people will say, hey, yeah, you're doing a great job. We'd love to have you work a couple of extra shifts, or, you know, here's a dollar an hour raise or something like that. And they're like, no, don't do that. If you do that, I'm going to lose whatever benefits I have that really allow me to provide well for my family. And
exactly. We're seeing so much that you see, you were much more articulate than I was. Thank you. But but that's the kind of thing that I'm seeing. And I'm thinking we shouldn't be punishing people for doing the right thing and being successful.
Yeah. Yeah. And you talked about signing up at, you know, needing different kinds of benefits, which when your income falls below a certain point, you do qualify for a bunch of different things. And that's at different levels, too. It's not just federal programs. It's federal, state, and local programs. But some of the software that was built to manage the data in these programs goes back to the 1960s and 70s. I'm talking about mainframe days. It's before PCs and before, you know, distributed networks and before even what would be considered now old technology. It's older than old, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the platforms that a lot of those benefit programs were written under. And so to change them so they can talk to other platforms is more than just a notion. And those are the things that happen behind the scenes that people need to pay for that costs a lot of money to fix. And so you say, well, okay, those are administrative costs. And everyone in the nonprofit world knows administrative cost is the worst thing you can call it. You can call it anything but administrative cost because somehow that's considered waste, which it isn't. It's critically important. And upgrading technology to make it easier for people to sign up for the benefits they qualify for is one clear example of investments you have to make, not just in access, but in the technology that's required to enable access, right? And state by state by state, every state has a different system. And again, you can talk about the values of, and these are policies again, saying we don't want the federal government to do programs. We want to push that down to the states, to the local level where the decisions need to be made. I get it, except then you have problems like this that are hard to solve.
They're hard to solve, but I am going to be a bit optimistic and suggest that the emerging tech, especially in the last few years, can make this solvable much more quickly than it has in the past. And so I'm hopeful maybe we'll get there and this won't be another extra set of burdens we have to put on the folks that are scraping by as it is.
Well, yeah. And even sometimes when you look at what people who work in government have to do every day, they're just scraping by, too. I mean, and I'm not talking about their wages. I'm talking about how many things they're required to get done during the day. It really is quite a lot that we ask of, you know, what we call our bureaucrats, right? But we ask a lot of our bureaucrats. And I don't think we give them enough credit for the work that they do.
I think that's absolutely right. I do. And it is a juggle because it's a person that might be really focused on agricultural policy, but is also looking at space policy and AI policy. And it's like one of so many things in someone's portfolio of issues. So, you know, that's at the it's depending on what level of government I suppose you're talking about, because, of course, we do have some good folks just focused on food. But the point is, you know, we're hopefully going to get better. And I certainly, even more than ever, appreciate the work that those folks are doing.
So what I heard from that conversation was platform programs and policies that were developed in the 1960s might need a fresh look.
Maybe a little bit.
Maybe, right?
Just a tweak.
And, you know, you were born in the 60s, Jerry.
Yeah, you know what, 10 years after you?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. So, you know, not everything that came out of the 60s is outdated.
Although you can reasonably say it needs a tweak.
Right. Might need an update, you know. So, all right. So I wish we had, like, you know, 6 hours with you, Cheryl, because you can add so much value here in such a short time. So this idea about programming and policies and in Jerry's mind, platforms that are outdated, you believe, and what you just said, is you have a little bit more hope and positive. But that is, for those of us who know you, we know that's true about you, just, and that's how you view life. That's your life lens. So is there a way for us to craft this in such a way that both people from both sides of the aisle would say that would be good for America? If no kid went hungry, child and hunger, those two words never went together in this country again. Is there a thought that you have that says, here's something I think we haven't done and that we should do, so this is appealing for every legislator to want to help solve the problem?
Well, I think most legislators, I would hope the vast majority, would say and probably mean that they want to address that. But I'm going to pivot a tiny bit because I think we're in a bit of a crisis in this moment. And it's not a specific policy crisis or funding crisis, although we can certainly talk about those too. But I'm really, really, really worried about the erosion of trust in the system. Because when families, when schools, when community organizations have built plans around expected support and then funding gets cut or reduced, as we've seen in a lot of places recently, it's not just about a gap in the resources in that moment, but it's this dramatic loss of trust. And then in turn, these institutions that have been doing good work are more reluctant to think about long-term planning. And a lot of these organizations have to operate in a crisis mode rather than building capacity that's sustainable over time. So what I'm really concerned is we did have some things that were working, and I spent a lot of time in the last year talking to community organizations that suddenly didn't have the funds that they were promised. I think building back from that is more than just, well, here are some better policies to fix it. I think fundamentally we've lost the trust of a lot of these well-intentioned organizations. And so we're going to have to work really hard to get that back. And I don't have an answer. It's something I'm watching and I feel deeply concerned about.
Well, I appreciate that answer, because we did see it in the fall when we said we're not going to pay SNAP. And these are people who went through the process, qualified, were approved, and our federal government said, we're going to come alongside you and help you with this need in your life. And then said, we didn't really mean that.
Yeah.
And that broken trust doesn't just work at the local level. It goes all the way through every layer of government and organizational folks like us who are trying to help. So, well said. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back more with Dr. Cheryl Kirshenbaum in just a moment. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for being with us. Jerry Brisson, Dr. Phil Knight, and our very, very, very special guest, Dr. Cheryl Kirshenbaum. And you can find Dr. Kirshenbaum at her website, which is CherylKirshenbaum.com. And Cheryl is S-H-E-R-I-L. And we should all be impressed, because I'm from Alabama.
He could put that many letters in a row and spell the right word.
Right.
You sure know how to make a guest feel welcome.
So, yeah, we can find you there, and your website is great. And so, you know, this is a This is something that Jerry and I have had on our hearts and in our minds for some time, to how do we get the have the right conversations with the right people at the right level in order to affect folks so that we all know better, but not just for the sake of knowledge, so that we can do better. So we can go to the next threshold of food security across the nation. And so we thank you. It's been great. It's great to have you here with us to have these conversations. And the only thing this is probably going to mean is that we're going to ask you to come back more often.
Anytime. It makes my day, honestly.
You know, I think that one of the worst ways to find out how valuable something is to quit doing it and see what happens.
Hmm.
Right? It's a terrible way to learn how valuable something is. The flip side of that, though, is the other way to learn how valuable something is to define it and measure it and quantify it as much as you can. I mean, there's things you can't quantify and you have to qualify, but even that process can be deliberate and clear and thoughtful. And so you're a scientist. I mean, first and foremost, you're a scientist. And I mean, when you talk about things like programs that have been unfunded, it goes totally counter to the basis for which science works.
But you're reminding me I should talk about what I think does work based on some of the research that I did in my academic career, that side of things, but also kind of based on what I saw working in government. And I should say this wasn't my first round in government. I worked for a different senator about 20 years ago. So the perspective was really interesting, seeing how much things had shifted in some ways, but then not really moved at all in other arenas in policy. But in my research, so what I ended up looking at what the priorities are for senior congressional staffers, so like chiefs of staff, legislative directors, senior policy people, who they listen to, whose opinion is most valued, and who gets heard when making decisions related to agriculture and other science policies. I won't go into too much detail because I don't want to bore listeners, but one of the things to come out of that, because I interviewed dozens of these senior congressional staffers, both current staff and then folks that had worked in previous administrations. And something that came up over and over was it was often not the scientist with the most publications coming through their office to talk about data or to tell a story. And it wasn't the think tanks, and it wasn't necessarily even the nonprofits that they were paying the most attention to. But probably one of the biggest influences on where they were on certain policy issues was the one individual with the personal story and the personal connection to an issue. So someone who came to talk to them who had experienced hunger firsthand, or if it was a chronic disease, those people stayed in their memory and might influence the way that they saw an issue. And that was definitely something that I observed when I was working on the Hill. And so I think finding the opportunity to tell individual stories is probably paramount to working toward a food secure future.
You know, it's amazing, Cheryl, that after all these years of being on the radio, how many people that have been in the studio on this call that had a story about food insecurity? Maybe it was themselves, or maybe it was their parents that they, you know, they got older. I say, as I was growing up, I had no idea that Tuesday night at the end of the month was, I just thought it was baloney night. But now when I look back, I go, oh, that's what we had. You know, I thought my dad really enjoyed breaking ground with a hand plow and planting a garden. I just thought he loved it. You know, and he grew the food so that it would help on the family budget. And it's amazing to me how many people we've had on the show through the years that food insecurity touched their life somewhere, some way along the line. So I think what you're saying is exactly right.
Yeah, it touches almost all of our lives in some way. I mean, my mom grew up not always being food secure, and it echoes through generations with behaviors that we carry forward or memories that we have and what we decide for future generations of our family. And so when I talk to folks who want to have influence in the policy discussion, I don't tell them to forget about all the data, but I say speak from your heart. Mm. And tell your story and bring someone with you who maybe, you know, is touched personally in this moment, because that matters. I mean, as a species, we're storytellers. That's I think above almost everything else. That's kind of what we carry forward, how we remember history, how we make plans for the future. And I think finding those stories can really move mountains in and out of policy.
You know, there's another report I just read out of the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy, which is also here in Michigan, coming out of Grand Rapids and working with Grand Valley State University. And they just produced a report, the 11 Trends in Philanthropy for 2026. The very first thing they talk about is eroding trust in nonprofit organizations. And while I read the summary, I have not read the whole report. I've just read the executive summary of what they were driving at there. And essentially, what they're indicating, at least, is that the reason for this eroding trust is because that's all we do is tell stories, and we don't really talk about the difference we make in the long term, and that people are fatigued by this, you know? Mm-hmm. So I only say this to say, I think you're right, that there's a lot of people that what moves them is a story. But as a community, we've got to somehow turn that story into effective policy that actually makes a difference, or it only lasts so long.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I couldn't agree more. And I think we should be thinking, like, I think there's been a lot of attention, just as an example, in the past couple of weeks about nutritional guidance from governments.
Mm-hmm.
But from the policy perspective, I'm also thinking about, like, what are the agricultural subsidies that exist and how does that shape what's affordable? But does it follow nutritional guidance at all? And if it doesn't, you know, we could be highlighting better ways to tie those things together. And maybe that's through story, and maybe that's through some really good organizations that are working in communities. And it's probably a combination of all of these. But there are these seemingly disparate pieces of a bigger story about food security that we can put together when we have the right narrative and then just make better choices. We're not going to get it perfect, but we can certainly do a better job than we have been.
I think that's super insightful. And I would say this, take something like diabetes, and I've worked in low-income communities for a long time and have a lot of diabetes in my own family. It is not ignorance that keeps people from eating right.
Right.
It's something else. Well, what is it? What are the stories that make up the behaviors that actually affect what people eat, how often? And when you start to connect what works for people in their life with what's best for people, most people want to get there with you. But it's a journey, and it's a hard journey, and it's one you've got to take a step at a time as you understand better, why am I eating so much pasta? Well, not only does it make me feel good, not only is it filling, right, which gives me comfort, not only is it what I learned how to make, and it's easy to make, and it's quick to make for my family, who gives a crap about my diabetes? I mean, but that's really, you know, the kinds of things that happen out there. And every healthcare has a way they're trying to grapple with it. There are nutrition people trying to grapple with it in a different way. But the bottom line is, if you don't work with the people who actually have to make the decision and figure out what helps them make the best decision for them, a decision they want to make, right? Mm-hmm. Somewhere in there, policy has to encourage that level of action.
Well, I hope it does. I think we can do a little better, but it should for sure.
So I think one of the things I heard from both of you guys is you got to help people where they're at, not where you wish they were.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that's what we're trying to do. I've said for several times that on this show that if I have a flat tire and I have to call a tow truck and he calls me back and says, I can get within a half mile of you, but you've got to get to me. That's not the tow truck I want. I want somebody to come and help me where I'm at, not a half mile. So it's the right conversation. It's the conversation with the right person, Jerry. And I think that this will uplift, this show will uplift people in a very, very positive way. And that's all thanks to you, Dr. Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
Oh, I was going to say being able to talk to you today uplifts me. I always leave our conversation. I can say always now. I've been on a few times. It's just it makes me feel very hopeful. And I hope that listeners are hopeful about the future of food security and where we're headed and where we could be headed. I think we need to reimagine things a bit and incorporate new technology. And what you just said, you know, think really carefully about who the people who need more services are and learn more about them. You have me thinking about this young man that I met who, when he arrived in this country, he had all of these supports that were supposedly there for him to provide some food to get him started, but he came from a different culture and no one had bothered to think about that. He didn't know how to use a can opener and access the food that was provided to him. So I think that there's a role for education in all this as well. But we can get there. So again, you make me feel hopeful.
Good. Well, that street's running both ways.
Yes.
So thanks for being with us, Cheryl Kirschenbaum. Folks, Jerry and I'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this edition of Food Secure Nation.
Food Secure Nation is sponsored by Know Better, Do Better. Engaging change makers, charting solutions, and driving progress for food security in America. Once again, here are Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson.
Jerry, Dr. Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
She's the best. And she's doing so many good things. And you know what? For people who want to be encouraged that there are smart people who are actively engaged in finding answers, this is the show to listen to. Cheryl is one of those people, and what an honor to have her on the show with us.
Yep. National figure, influencer at many, many different levels. It's great. Jerry, time for a little food for thought. Food insecurity is not a failure of compassion, but it could be a failure of alignment. And that's some of what Cheryl talked about today. When systems fall short, the need doesn't disappear. It shifts on the families, communities, and the charitable food network that was never designed to carry the full weight of policy shortfalls. A food secure nation isn't built by choosing between government or charity. It's built when each does what it can do and does it well. And that's how we build a food secure nation.